This episode is brought to you by Shared Interest. Shared Interest's mission is to provide finance that transforms lives, providing a hand up, not a handout, to some of the most disadvantaged communities across the globe. By investing with Shared Interest, you can help farmers and artisans around the world earn fair incomes and trade their way out of poverty to build a fairer, more sustainable future. Shared Interest, where your money makes a world of difference. Visit the link in our show notes to learn more.
I think if we sit around waiting for fascism to come back, you know, with swastikas and flags, that's not what it's going to look like. I think it's more that we'll just see the erosion of liberal democracy and universal human rights, and they will disappear rather than there being a march on Rome in 22 or something similar, you know.
Welcome to The World Unspun. My name is Bethany Riley, and I'm a co-editor at New Internationalist magazine, taking over the mic for this week's episode. As an independent media cooperative, we don't have an editor-in-chief, and no billionaire backers tell us what we should and shouldn't publish. Instead, our co-owners vote for the topics they want us to cover in depth. Over the last year in particular, the rise of the global far right has been a really big issue for us and for our readers. So for our current issue, I wanted to understand a bit more about how ideologies that were once confined to the fringes are now dictating the agenda from inside the halls of power. As you can probably imagine, this research has taken me to some pretty dark places. I found myself trawling through videos of people like Elon Musk speaking at far-right gatherings.
I think there's, like, frankly, too much of a focus on past guilt, and we need to move beyond that. Children should not be guilty of the sins of their parents.
Disappearing into online rabbit holes of influencers like Andrew Tate.
Life for a man is harder than life for a woman. We need to have a lot of shit to be an important man. To be a woman, you need makeup.
And watching surreal pronatalist conferences where the former Hungarian president, Katalin Novak, a major figure in the global far-right anti-abortion movement, applauded attendees for having huge families.
So now I just turn to those people, still at childbearing age, who didn't stand up now, but still have the chance to have a family and still have plans about having children. Don't be afraid.
Today, it feels like the far right is everywhere. Their parties have recently made historic wins from Germany to Portugal to Japan. And as I put pen to paper to edit our latest edition on the global far right at the start of July, racist rioting broke out in the Spanish region of Murcia, with far-right gangs calling on people to actually hunt down North African migrants in the streets. The horrible scenes felt really familiar. It was like a repeat of last summer's racist rioting in Britain, when mobs tried to burn down hotels housing asylum seekers.
Riots erupted on the streets of Southport last night, following a knife attack on Monday, which left three girls dead and other young children in a critical condition.
But I also found light. I work with journalists reporting in pockets of resistance in India, Argentina, and the US. And I also visited a little village in my home of Catalonia, where local historians are keeping anti-fascist struggles against Franco alive for the next generation of kids. These conversations gave me hope. And I know that for many of our readers, these stories give them hope too. To make sense of this moment and to better understand what we can do to turn the tide on the global far right, I sat down with Joe Mulhall, Research Director at Hope Not Hate, which is an anti-fascist organisation in the UK. Joe has spent over a decade investigating the far right, sometimes going undercover into extremist groups, from British street movements to vigilante anti-migrant militias in the US. His work today combines exposing far-right networks with building resilience in communities vulnerable to their politics. Joe explains why the far-right is gaining ground around the world, where resistance can take root, and what communities are doing to resist the UK's own far-right party, Reform. Stay tuned for our conversation.
Everyone I speak to has a different definition for what the far right actually is. So how do you define it?
So I hope not hate, we define the far right as, like, far right is an umbrella term, right, which includes two elements, which is the populist radical right and the extreme far right. And broadly speaking, the way we divide them is the populist radical right believe it, in one sense, ostensibly still believe in democracy, but they're anti-liberal democracy and the tenets of liberal democracy, universal human rights and the like. Whereas the extreme far right are fundamentally anti-democratic, as well as rejecting, you know, universal human rights, equality, etc. And then there's, you know, there's other various dividing lines between them. One, you know, the extreme far right is usually more overtly anti-Semitic, say, and the other side is less so. Some of the radical right is often culturally nationalist, whereas the extreme right is racially nationalist. So we kind of divide it there. And then there's also populism, which sits above it, which is this kind of thin ideology, which ostensibly splits the people into, or the country into, the pure people and the corrupt elite. So those are kind of our definitions that we work. In terms of where the most power is, I mean, on the extreme far right, those are the people that are going to bomb a mosque, bomb a synagogue, pull off someone's headscarf, engage in street violence and those sorts of things. But now, of course, the populist radical right, that element of the far right is in parliamentary chambers all over the world, or in, you know, many cases is president of America, or previously was Bolsonaro in Brazil, and there's still Modi in India, and we've got Orban in Hungary, and, you know, Meloni in Italy, and you can unfortunately keep going on.
And you've kind of been doing this work for over a decade of investigating and kind of countering the far right. How does 2025 compare, and does this moment feel different to you?
Yeah, it feels worse, really depressingly. I mean, when I first started getting involved in anti-fascist kind of activism back in 2009, 2010, in the general election, it was the BNP was the big far-right threat in the British National, you know, in the UK, which were a very extreme political party. You know, at its core, it was still this neo-Nazi party with you know, Holocaust deniers and the like. But if you look at last year, for example, in England, 2024, we had the general election where Reform, a populist radical right party, got, I think, 14.1% of the vote, which is the largest vote share of any far-right party in British history. Then we had Tommy Robinson, the kind of the infamous anti-Muslim activist, had a street demonstration in July in London that had possibly well over 40,000 people on it, which is by some way the largest far-right street demonstration we've seen in decades, and if not longer. And then we had the riots, right, which was the most widespread period of far-right violence we've probably ever had in Britain, probably even larger than, say, the Notting Hill riots in 1958. So here you've got those three events. You've got the largest vote share, the largest street mobilization, and the most widespread period of far-right violence all happening at one time. And mm-hmm. since then, things have escalated still. You know, Reform have now got well over 800 councillors. They've got over 400 branches. They've got, you know, a quarter of a million members. So in many ways, I think we've faced more challenges than any time that I've been involved. And part of that is not just because it's happening here. This is a genuinely global phenomenon now. You know, it's been dragging along and growing unevenly for the last 30 years. But is now in a really, really extraordinarily dangerous in terms of its scale and reach.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I wanted to talk about next, that we have got, you know, Javier Milei in Argentina. The far right is in power, either as the main party or as a kind of junior partner in seven countries in Europe, I believe, Modi in India, Bukele in El Salvador. What's your kind of assessment of how we got to this moment? Why is the far right rising across the globe?
It's, in one sense, it's a really difficult question, right? Which is how, why is, in some senses, an ostensibly similar phenomenon happening in such diverse countries, as you say, America, Argentina, India, huge chunks of Europe, etc. In many ways, the differences between those nations and the causes of what's their own politics are as diverse and different as they are similar. But I think there are some commonalities, right? I think you can, you know, there's things such as, you know, globalization, I think, has been fundamentally important to understanding this. And while globalization has had many positives, it seems to have that, like, international globalization has created dislocation internally within countries. You know, I think economics has played a huge role in this, kind of neoliberal economics and the spread of neoliberal economics around the world. Broadly speaking, though, I think at its simplest, I think we can argue that in lots and lots of countries, the status quo is not working, right? For lots of, you know, normal, quote-unquote normal people, mainstream politics for too long has failed to meet material needs of their lives. Right, and this has been dragging on for, you know, longer, you know, going on for long periods, and the far right offer extraordinarily easy and simple answers to these really complex questions, and so that as a result they're really effective there. And then finally, I'd say I think there's also this sense of, like, almost like epochal change happening, right? Which is one of the things the far right offer is they offer a vision of change, right? It might be nonsensical, it might be full of lies, and it might be, you know, built on sand. But they say to people, look, this is what the world's going to look like. This is what the country's going to look like if you vote for us. And that's a really powerful message. But for long periods of time, when these were small, fringe, marginal groups, they were offering the world to people. And that just sounded nonsense because they had no power. But I think there is this sense of momentum and energy within far-right movements around the world, whereby they're looking at each other. There's these transnational connections. There's money going around the globe, but there's also the use of tactics, iconography, all of these things, so that they're inspiring each other over the last 35 years, and they're basically crowdsourcing the most effective forms of politics, this populist form of politics, that what works in one place, they're taking the bits that have worked there, and then they're using it in their own countries and own contexts. And so I think this global sense of change is happening.
You've kind of warned before about the risk of another fascist era. Would you say we're there now, or the risk is greater?
No, I don't think we're there now. I mean, one thing that's absolutely clear, I think, is that, if we do enter a new fascist age, it's not going to look like it did in the 1930s. It's not going to be jackboots men, marching down the road, Sieg Heiling. And in many ways, I think actually the what we're currently witnessing, rather than say the resurgence of explicit fascism internationally, is this emergence of illiberal democracy. If you look at, say, the commonalities between Orban in Hungary and previously Law and Justice in Poland, or Sweden Democrats Le Pen, Vox and Chega on the Iberian Peninsula, Meloni in Italy, AfD in Germany, Reform in the UK, etc. You go around, these groups, in many senses, I mean, of course they have fascists in them. Most of these groups have fascists in them, and many of them came out of traditional neo-Nazi and fascist parties many decades ago. But most of the politics they're advancing somehow sits within broadly the confines of a democratic system. But they just are, they want to eradicate any form of liberal democracy. And now, some of these semantic discussions don't really matter if you're on the hard end of that politics and you're being attacked by those political parties. But I think it's important to make the point in that I think if we sit around waiting for fascism to come back, with swastikas and flags, that's not what it's going to look like. But I think we will see, we've seen really clearly the dramatic rise of authoritarian, dictatorial, anti-democratic, illiberal, politics all over the world in these different places. And I think it's more that we'll just see the erosion of liberal democracy and universal human rights, and they will disappear rather than there being a march on Rome in 22 or something similar,
In terms of who is attracted to far-right ideologies at the moment, I mean, there's kind of a widespread perception that it's driven by working class resentment, the kind of left behind and the white working class. But there's also different shades of study as well that suggest support for the far-right comes from more affluent supporters and elites. What do you make of that?
Clearly, the thing is that while a lot that you could talk about the economics in the really obvious places like, economically deprived post-industrial communities, and you can say, well, we need to make their lives better economically, and houses, schools, hospitals, those things are true. It's still in the other communities, often even the more affluent communities, there's still a sense of decline, which is important, this notion of declinism. Even though it might be relative decline, there's still a sense that their children won't do better than they will, or that their kids won't be able to get the houses they won't be able to afford the schools they want to go to, etc. Or that then Britain generally is a national declining nation, etc. So I think even across both economically more affluent and economically deprived communities, that sense of declinism is something that unites them all, even though one's maybe much more acute and the other one is more relative. I think that you can see it across both of them. So until we make people's lives feel better, and I mean that in the broadest, fluffy sense almost, but until people feel that in the hard end, feel that actually their lives are going to get better because they're in really economically deprived situations, but also across the sense that Britain is actually working, that the state works, that things are, you can get a doctor's appointment, all these things that affect people from a set range of classes. I think that the far right are going to always be able to prey on that sense of declinism across all of those groups.
Yeah. That is true, yeah. And it's something that I recently went to a talk by a councillor in Wales, and they were talking about how Reform is growing in popularity in kind of ex-mining communities like Merthyr Tydfil, and Reform are promising to kind of reopen mines. And I mean, promises that would never, ever be kept, that are completely pie in the sky, but people seem to be attracted to that and believe it.
Yeah, and look, the polling right now suggests that Reform will win the Senedd elections next year in Wales. But that them saying they'll open the mines is very similar to kind of Burn Baby Burn by Trump in America when he was going to the Rust Belt and say we're going to be reopening the mine industries there, sort of thing. Part of the issue is that the reason some of these communities are so decimated is because deindustrialization in those communities took certain jobs and replaced them with kind of work in Amazon factories, etc. There is a people looking back and missing those sorts of jobs where you could have a good living, etc. There was trade unions, there was work, all those things. And that sense of nostalgia, and it's not even an unfair nostalgia, but I think it is a really powerful tool that populist radical right parties like Reform are really good at tapping into. And they say, yeah, your lives were better 40 years ago, and we'll bring that back for you. Look, make America great again, as simple as that slogan is, right? And I think, you know, it won't be any surprise if Reform are saying make Wales great again. You know, I mean, that's the sort of politics that's really powerful.
You've done a lot of undercover work into extreme far-right groups. What was the most surprising thing you learnt during that experience, and what lessons did you take from it to be able to now tackle those ideologies?
I think the biggest thing that struck me was how normal so many of the people were, right? And by that I mean, I always remember being in this militia group in Alabama, right? And they were really extreme. We would dress up as soldiers, go down to the Mexican border, and they would do these patrols on the Mexican border. They were looking for ISIS coming across. There wasn't much ISIS coming across the Mexican border, but there was people smugglers, and there was drug smugglers and all these sorts of things. And they were the sweetest guys you'd ever met, right? But obviously they thought I agreed with them, right? So I was white, so I was predisposed to it. But they were all that thing about Southern hospitality. I lived at their houses for a period, and like they were all unbelievably kind and nice and friendly. And then I remember we went out to get some petrol or gas, and this guy leant over the sweet counter. I was looking at sweets. One of the guys I was with, and he just goes, oh, by the way, I've got this list of mosques, and when the race war starts, I'm going to wipe all these mosques out. And it was just like this huge disconnect. It was like, are you just been the loveliest guy for the last 3 days? But you're also genocidally racist, you know, and violently racist, and you've got semi-automatic rifles all over your house. And it's a really useful lesson in that I think sometimes liberals and progressive movements and the left take comfort in the idea that they're not like us. That, like, we talk about them like they're monsters or reptilian, you know, and we take comfort in that because, you know, me, my friends and my family, etc., you know, we're normal, nice people. The far right is normal people with horrifying politics, and it doesn't excuse it in any way whatsoever. But I think it's less comforting to realize that it's normal people. So that means Reform supporters will be in our families, in our trade unions, they'll be in our workplaces in many cases, they'll be drinking down our local pub, they'll be playing for our local football team, all the, you know. And I think until we understand that better and understand what motivates those normal people to engage in awful forms of politics, we're in real trouble.
In terms of the work Hope Not Hate does, it's, as you say, kind of exposing them. Because understanding what they're up to is key to being able to resist it, and showing what they're doing behind the surface, I guess, if they're kind of presenting a more moderate face on the surface of things. Can you tell me more about that work?
My team's job is to monitor, understand, expose, infiltrate, and ostensibly make sure that the difference between the image they're presenting to the world and the reality of their core politics is exposed. But the other side of the organisation is about attempting to work in the communities that are susceptible to the politics of the far right. But it's about understanding why those communities and those individuals are susceptible to that politics, why they're being preyed on, and why that messaging is working. That community work is fundamentally important to almost inoculate communities against far-right politics, so that they have a sense of pride and community amongst them. And in an age where we're all, I think, feeling uprooted, where the funding has disappeared, there's no youth clubs, there's no libraries, there's no communal spaces in most of our communities now. People don't go to churches anymore. Trade unions have fewer members. Like, where are these communal spaces anymore? And pubs are shutting down in many places. That sense of dislocation is something that the far right can really prey on.
And do you see it as effective?
Yeah, I mean, I would still be here if I didn't think it was successful. So I think on the most extreme end, we've been super useful at splitting up organisations, marginalising and attacking, exposing groups so that they don't grow. We do a huge amount of data work at the moment. You know, we're putting vast polls into the field to try and segment both who are Reform supporters, but also what does British society actually look like, so we can have much more targeted messaging. Just screaming racist Reform is not going to work, you know, but in certain areas, like, for example, I'll say when I was up in County Durham, on the doorstep, they're talking about the fact that actually those communities want way more workers' rights, and Reform vote against workers' rights. That's a much more useful wedge issue about trying to turn people away from Reform than just screaming racist. So that sort of work, I think, will be really useful. And I'll say next year is going to be the huge test case. I think it's going to be more losses over the next few years than victories. But I think this is a four-year project now. You know, I mean, this is about saying how many seats do we need to stop Reform winning at the next general election so that they can't be the government, which would have sounded inconceivable a year ago, but really is actually probably one of the questions now.
And I wondered what you thought as well about how important culture is in the pushback. You've written about music and resistance, but the far right also uses music. I was thinking a bit about Hindut for Pop, for example, in India, which there's a lot of incitement of violence against minorities, against Muslims. So how can culture kind of cut through that? How can we claim that back?
Luckily, with kind of, say, far-right music, we're lucky that most of it's dreadful. Right? We're going to talk about music, which is helpful. You know, it doesn't have a mass appeal. You know, music's there. I think it does a few things, right? One is about how do we create culture that has influence on the debate. You know, in the last few years, for example, in television, if you think about, you know, Mr. Bates versus the Postman, that had more effect than years of journalists doing amazing work on the post office scandal. All of a sudden it became this massive national issue, and that was because it was consumable and it was entertaining and it was interesting and it was done really well. Adolescence, again, would be another one. Again, amazing people have been spending years talking about the manosphere and the role of incels, you know, all these sorts of things, and doing great work and getting cut through. But adolescence then becomes this huge global hit because it was presented in a different way, and I think that's really important. You know, making resistance cool, making resistance interesting, making young people, it's like Rock Against Racism in the 70s. You know, when people talk about standing in Victoria Park, I mean, this was long before I was around, but, you know, they talk about standing in Victoria Park and going, God, I'm not alone. You know, realizing that actually when it sometimes feels like we're losing, I think the huge role that culture can play is it allows us to remember that we're not alone. In many cases, it reminds us that we're still actually in a majority of those people that reject far-right politics. And sometimes you can go to a concert and just for that hour, you have that rush of energy and solidarity and a sense of, oh, actually, there's other people like me. I can go up, I can carry on again.
You've said that you are worried about the next few years, that there might be more losses than wins. I just wanted to end on what is giving you hope at this moment.
You know, the far right always have lost. They've had periods of success and they've had periods of victory, but they are always beaten back. And that will happen again in this instance. You know, this is a wave of really dangerous global far right politics, which is on the rise unevenly all over the world in many cases. And that's going to be horrible and it's going to have really awful effects, but they will be beaten back, as it always has been at some point. So there's hope in that. And the reason it'll be beaten back is because people that opposed far-right politics remain in a majority, right? Which means the only way we lose is if we don't fight. You know what I mean? Like, and in some senses, that's going to require kind of popular front sort of politics. It's going to involve collaborating with people we fundamentally disagree with on a whole range of issues. But if we don't want the far-right to win, in many cases, we have to accept that we need there's more of us together that disagree with far-right politics, and we're going to have to find ways to collaborate across those groups, across society. But that's really hopeful, because it means if we're in a majority, it means the only way we lose is within our power. We lose if we choose not to collaborate and fight, and if we do choose to collaborate and fight, then we will win.
That was Joe Mulhall. He is the Director of Research at Hope Not Hate and the author of numerous books on post-war fascism, including Drums in the Distance, Journeys into the Global Far Right, and Rebel Sounds, Music as Resistance. This episode is part of our ongoing coverage on the global far right, including our latest issue. Subscribe to read in-depth features on how Argentina's social movements are pushing back against the far-right president Javier Milei's attacks on the poor, the role of American trade unions in tackling Trump, and how interfaith couples facing Hindu supremacist violence in India are continuing to live and love against the odds. Subscribe today at newint.org or via the link in our bio. This episode was hosted by me, Bethany Riley. I'm a co-editor at New Internationalist. My co-editors are Amy Hall, Conrad Landin, Nick Dowson, and Decca Muldowney. Maxine Betteridge-Mose is our digital editor, and our editorial assistant is Paula Lacey. Our theme music has been produced by Samuel Raphael Williams, and our logo design is by Mari Foos. Audio editing is by Nasik Hamza. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.